Good afternoon. I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for joining me for the 247th edition of New Mainers Speak. This is a bi-weekly half-hour program where you can hear firsthand about the lives of some of Maine's immigrants. During this show, we visit with individuals regarding their life stories and enduring hopes as New Mainers. My guest today is Mirgani Alari. He comes from the Nubal Mountains of Sudan. That's a place caught between the two countries of Sudan and South Sudan. Mirgani came to the United States in 1986 as a teenager to serve a family in L.A. In 2007, he and his wife moved to Maine with their growing family, and today they live with their five children in Portland, Maine, where Mirgani manages a group home for people with disabilities. So happy to have you here on the show, Mirgani. Thank you for coming to New Mainers Speak.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
I'd love it if you would start with the gorgeous region of the Nubal Mountains where you grew up.
Well, the area that I grew up in is a beautiful, beautiful mountainous region that also is a tropical and is a mixture of climate that happens there. 30 years ago, it's a lot different now than 30 years ago, although I haven't been there since I left. I can see from pictures and from stories of how much it has changed. Because growing up there, to be exact, 35 years ago, there were waters running down the mountains 24/7. You go to the nearest water reserve and you can drink from any running water. Unfortunately, it's not the same these days. I heard now you have to go far away to gather water. You got to get it from the wells. So it's pretty different now than it was before.
What's the cause of the drying?
Well, I know people don't believe in climate change, but from experience, I believe it's a climate change. Global warming is definitely not definite since I'm not a scientist. I could say if it's true from what we read from the scientist's point of view, I can say it's a definite global warming effect. Because there is no other way you can explain that kind of thing.
Yeah. And how many brothers and sisters did you have growing up in that area?
I grew up in a family of two moms. You know, I have a mom and a stepmother whom are still alive. They're growing in age, and my dad also is still alive. So we have a family of eight and four, you know. So, yeah. So I grew up in a large family. The third oldest from my mom, who is the first mom. And as a third child, the first one is a girl who was helping mom in the farm and, you know, food gathering and things like that. And the second one is a boy who was sent out to the farm where he can take care of cows, goats, you know, animals in the farm. So coming up as a third boy, I was the only one who was sent to school because I guess my dad put me to school because he figured he doesn't need me as much at home, maybe. So, yeah, so I was lucky to be sent to school, but I was underage, so I had to be put in a boarding school because we have to walk literally about an hour and a half to 2 hours each way to go to school and back. So I couldn't do that as a small, you know, toddler, I guess, they decided to put me in a boarding school.
Wow, so you were far away from your family a lot of the time.
Yes, pretty much most of my life now, thinking about it.
Right. Wow, that's very interesting. Did either of your parents have the opportunity to go to school?
No. Growing up there, I was the first one to go to school in my family, my immediate family. And so literally I was the first generation to go to school.
Did you feel lucky to be the one to get to go to school, or did you feel like the rest of the family was doing something else and you'd been sent away?
They're both, you know, feelings of guilt. And I don't want to say envy because I know they've struggled and they're still struggling a lot more than I am. But there's so much burden that goes with that too. Because I'm the only one here from the immediate family who ever left home and the country and being here. So there's such a tremendous burden on my shoulder that I have to provide for them and my kids here So yeah, so there's definitely both. They get to enjoy the life there, the being in the beautiful land that I loved. They got to struggle with basic needs, where I don't struggle with basic needs, but at the same time miss all the family gathering, the relatives, the partying, and all that thing that family do. So yeah, so it's pretty mixed feelings.
I think that's so honest. I'm sure whenever people leave home, of course you're moving towards something, but you're also moving away from something
exactly.
At the very same time.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. Do your kids ask you to tell them stories about your childhood?
Oh, I think they're pretty much getting tired of hearing the story.
Because my understanding is that you had quite a lot of freedom.
Yes, here I tried to engage them in a educational learning of who I am and who they are and where I came from, so they can get a bigger picture of what being here means, you know, and what you can do for the better, because the opportunities is here, especially in our kids. They don't have to struggle as we did. They don't have to walk an hour to go to school. You know, none of that stuff that experience they experience. So I try to give them a little take on life so that they can hopefully learn from it and know that just because we have abundance of everything doesn't mean that we can take it for granted, because you never know how long is that going to last. And if you waste the time, you might not get it back. So that's really my story that I try to tell them. But they're hurt enough already. So, and I can see that they've been listening from their behavior and from their academic learning and everything. I think they got the picture. Those who are old enough to get the picture.
Yeah, you really helped them to get some perspective on life.
Yes, definitely.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Not take things for granted.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say a little bit about what the conflict is all about in your home region?
Yeah, my home region conflict goes way, way back since the colonization, the British colonization, until after the independence of Sudan in 1956. We are the Nuba people, the Nubians, and we are the original Sudanese people who've been there for, you know, generations and thousands of years. So after the colonization, the British and the Egyptians colonized Sudan, and because of their knowledge and education, you know, it's really no different than what American Indians went through here. So we have very similar stories. The Egyptian Arabs and the British got together, and basically our ancestors could not read or write, so they'll go with whatever they tell them. You know, let's work together, let's build a country together. They can do whatever they want with the resources and how they want the country run. And that's how the Islamization started coming, and they teach them Arabic, which is the national language now in Sudan, at least they live in a small western or southern region. And then the religion, the language, and they actually force people to learn Arabic. You know, they change then your name to Arabic name. Yeah.
What language did you speak growing up?
It's called Rotana. Rotana.
Yeah.
Growing up, we have a lot of dialects. So we have hundreds of dialects that are spoken by tribes. Every tribe has its own language, basically. So you'll have someone from Maine will have their own language, someone from Boston have their own language, and so on. So, yeah, I got into history now. I forgot what
I think
what
that's
we
great. I was asking what the conflict was about.
Yeah. We were marginalized, as we still are to this day. As we speak, there are people still marginalized. And as the years go by, people become more and more educated, beginning to know of their rights, of even right of existence. It was in question. To this day, it's still in question, and it's unfortunate that the world is not paying attention. We're not being paid attention to, because I don't think it's my own opinion that the big nation countries, they don't think that there's much that they can gain out of saving the people of Nuba, maybe.
Like maybe oil?
Yeah. Like oil or whatever else they're going to feel worthy of saving the people. Because everything these days now, unfortunately, is all quid pro quo. You know, unfortunately, this is from my own point of view. It's going to be hard for our government to go in and say, hey, you know, let's just save these people because we're nice people. I'll wait to see what happens after the 20th of January, if things are going to get worse or better. You know, everything revolves around politics. Yeah, so it's very complicated when it comes to Sudan conflict. The bottom line is, it all comes down to race. The goal is to literally maybe just completely get rid of every dark-skinned person in Sudan. It doesn't make sense to create a genocide in the area there to say that we're maybe defending religion. You know, it doesn't make sense. Nuba is a mix. It's a Christian and Muslim together, living side by side. You know, for generations, they lived there without any issues until the Arabization came to play. And now suddenly there is a problem. So I think it has to do with the race, and they're using religion as a cover to rally the cause. Even now, they're brainwashing those people who are or Nubians or Darfurians who are Muslims to go and kill their own family, saying that you're Muslim, you should defend your religion, you shouldn't be dealing with people who are non-Muslim and so forth. So in any conflict, there is a core issue. And until that's dealt with, it's never going to change. There will be someone who will say, oh, I'm for peace, just to further advance his agenda or her agenda. So until we deal with the core issue of racial extermination, we're never going to be solved. You know? Yeah.
Your family growing up clearly knew that there were limited opportunities in the area. So they cleverly thought, well, we'll have some to help on the farm and we'll educate some and we'll see what happens. That was pretty strategic.
It was very strategic because my dad, who was able to also travel to the big city, was able to foresee what the future is going to look like. You don't have to be a scientist to figure out, okay, what is going on now? What are people saying? What kind of things are happening? To kind of plan ahead, you know, try to be on the safe side, or at least prepare yourself for the unknown, so to speak. So, yeah, they knew. They knew because the way they were treated, it was no different than the 1800s to 1960s America. It's no different, you know? So, of course, they've seen that. They've seen that happening. There are people graduate, they got university degrees. They can't find work. They will bypass them. My brother, who I was supporting to go to school there, he took a test, and he was very good in math. He was hoping to become an accountant. I was sending money. He would take a test, and everything is fine. They take the money. He will take a test. Then when the results come, he goes to get his results. And they will tell him, oh, we couldn't find your paper. Like, what? You couldn't find my paper? I paid the fee. Have you given me the exam? I took the exam. All I want is my result. Now you can't find my paper. Oh, sorry, you're going to have to repeat. You're going to have to repeat again. So you call me up. Hey, you know, this happened, and now they want me to repeat. The second time I send him the money, the same result. The third time I say, listen, if this happened a third time, forget about it. Just pick up your stuff, go back to the Nuba Mountain. And that's what he did. The third time, it happened. You know, there is something wrong here. So basically, they don't want to give him a certificate. It's a straight-out racist way of saying, no, we're denying your education. Or even though you've done it, you've shown you're very smart in math, but we're not going to give it to you. We're not going to prove it that you've earned it.
You're saying he's a citizen of Sudan. But he's black, and then
right.
Because he's black, the Sudanese government won't even process his test.
That's correct. And his story is not unique. That's the problem. The whole purpose is, you know, the more educated the people are, the more they will want to share the piece of pie, and we don't want to. We want to deny them the piece of pie.
Makes them a threat.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You decided you weren't going to live that way, and you had an opportunity to come to the United States and work for a family in Beverly Hills. What did you do for that family?
Well, I believe it was around June of 1984, to be exact. Went to the big city. I was gathering a supply for school. I believe that year it was a massive starvation in Africa, you know,
feed
where,
the world, right?
Yep, in Africa. So I was in a boarding school, and there was no food. There was no wheat or flour for food for the people who stay in the boarding school. So we had to go back home, and there was no use for me home. I was young, and I didn't even know what I was getting myself into or what I was going, to be honest. I met this businessman, nice guy, just like doing daily labor kind of work. Went there, I was assisting them with basically cleaning the garden, to serving them tea, going to get bread, newspaper, thing of that nature. After a while, I spent about a year, 2 years, then he was coming to the state for a visit. That was in 84, spent 2 years there. 86, he asked if I could tag along for a visit. So I had no clue where I was going. I didn't even know, you know, America was. I figured, oh, 6 months is not a big deal. I will go, and my family in Nuba Mountain, they didn't even know I was gone because there was not enough time to let them know that I was leaving. Then a week later, we end up in Beverly Hills, California, where he also has a house there. So that's where I spend from 86 until 98 or so in Beverly Hills, doing the same thing, serving them. But of course, coming here, I didn't speak any English. There was no word in English. I had, you know, was staying with a family who speak Arabic, and there was no friends. I didn't know anybody in Beverly Hills. There was no Sudanese in Beverly Hills or in LA, for that matter, at that time. So there was no way for me to get around or communicate or go anywhere, you know, other than the house, because where would I go with no English in Beverly Hills? So, yeah, so life was good at the beginning, you know, coming here, you see everything is all different, it's beautiful, it was all nice. Then after a while, it turned into like, okay, then what? You know, I'm stuck. It ended up looking like more like a jail cell than Beverly Hills to me, to be honest. Not knowing the language, it's not easy.
That was really hard. You ended up taking night classes, didn't you?
Yeah, so after a while, after years and years of being there, and one of his friends came over and saw me. I guess he saw the anguish in my face or the maybe depression. You know, I can laugh about it now. He's like, what do you do with your life today? What do you do? You know, and so I'm like, well, I mean, what can I do? There's not much I can do. With limited mobility, nothing. Didn't have any English. So he's like, well, there's, you know, adult school over there where I go. You can enroll there and you can maybe try to learn English. So literally from that day, I'm like, I owe everything to this guy. Literally. I said, where is that? You know, where is this school? So I said, can we go there now? He's like, okay, I'll come and get you tomorrow and we'll go, you know. And the good thing was this family, they have to leave every 6 months. And then they'll go out and they come out with the new visa and they're good. Where I cannot go out and I'm stuck there and there is no visa. I was put in a school, like private, like temporary private school where that day they can issue a visa, student visa. So I was really happy thinking, wow, this guy really want to, you know, educate me. Coming to find out, it was not really for me, but more for him, wanting to have the visa so I can stay legally stay without trouble. I know. It's like, wow, this is interesting, you know, and this is someone who's actually from Sudan too. I mean, I'm like, come on. Anyway, at least I was grateful he brought me here. So after I got the visa, he stopped paying the school. So I had to get kicked out of school and then back to the house. There I go, back to the house and continue serving them for a while. And then I continue with my school. And then when they leave, they leave the country every 6 months. When they leave, then I will do whatever I can to do some kind of work with friends and say, guys, I need anything. I need to save some money for my paperwork because I'm now illegal. And God knows, any day I could be deported, I know. So I talked to this person who knew me from the beginning. So she was aware of my circumstances. She's now my sister, by the way. You know, she's from Philippines, of descent, but she came here since she was young. She can relate to that story. And she ended up working with an attorney. And then so I said, listen, hey, can you talk to your boss? See if you guys can help me out here. Because, you know, I'm in need of papers. I got nothing. So then she said, okay. And then I worked here and there and gathered some money for paperwork. So then I applied for political asylum, and then I had to go, and it was so hard. So just to make the story short, I was granted a green card, and I was able officially to continue my school, and then was able to leave the family after I got my first job with the News Corp, 1997. I got my job as an office clerk with the News Corp, Fox Station, News Corp in L.A. So I said, you know what? Guys, thank you very much for bringing me here, giving me the opportunity to be here. But I don't think I can no longer continue with this. I got to be more than this in my life. It's up to me now to go and make something of my life, but I will no longer continue to be working with you, but I'll be around if you need me.
That's really impressive that you could get out of that difficult situation and still not burn any bridges.
Yes, yes.
If you're just joining this conversation, welcome. You're listening to New Mainers Speak. I'm Kate Manahan, and my guest today is Mirgani Alari. He is from the Nubal Mountains of Sudan. He came to the United States, where he was basically an indentured servant until he got some language classes and started working for Fox News, and then found his way to Maine. What is it like being a Mainer?
I'm glad I came to this state in California for, I guess it was 21 years, I believe I spent in California. It's a beautiful state. It's a very nice state, but I experienced some really kind of like racial kind of thing during that time where I was subjected to pullovers. I think it was a racial profiling, I think it was called. You know, I'd be pulled over and just be asked where I was going, you know, give them the address. Then they will follow me. They will follow me until I get to the door because I guess being black and living in Beverly Hills was kind of unusual, maybe. But
yeah,
for me, I didn't know. Yeah.
It sounds like that happened a lot.
Yeah. During that time in the 80s, it was pretty bad with that city. There were even movie stars start complaining about being pulled over going through Beverly Hills.
Have you had the experience of being pulled over and racially profiled here in Maine?
Now, man, since I've been here with the law enforcement, I had nothing but good things with them. I really don't see that happening anymore. So
I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah.
And you've been parenting. You've been raising your family here, and your kids go to the Portland Public Schools. Your twins are at Casco Bay High School, and somehow you found your way to Portland Community Squash. I wonder if you could describe for listeners what Portland Community Squash is, what it's about.
I am trying to get the words out to the community about Portland Squash. This is a really great after-school program that works in conjunction with the schools here in Portland to try to, you know, help especially the disadvantaged kids, the immigrants, kids due to language barriers, education, family income. I mean, it's a really, really good program that is trying to give our kids a chance to catch up, you know, for lack of better words, to catch up with the rest of the kids in Maine. And they've been really doing a great job with my kids. They're doing a really great job with their academic, with their sports. So I don't know what I would have done without them. They helped me because I'm never home, you know. They helped me with transporting kids to programs, playing squash, or taking them on field trips. So they've done a lot for me and my family, to be honest. So I really wish everybody will kind of get to know the Portland Squash and get to learn about it and see what a good program it is because it's a really great program.
I will put a link to Portland Community Squash because it is a terrific program. Like you said, they pick your kids up at school. They take them to the squash courts. And if people don't know what squash is, it's like racquetball or tennis. It's in a room with a ball that doesn't bounce very much.
Yeah.
And it's generally considered a pretty exclusive elite sport. However, they've really opened their doors, and it's for everybody. And yes, I'm so impressed with this program. When I look into it, I think, my goodness, what a fabulous offering for families, because then they take your kid home at the end of the day. And so when you're coming home from your second job, they're your kids. Everyone's coming together at the end of the day.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, couldn't be more happier and prouder of the people running the program. Yeah.
Is that why you wanted to join their board, to keep supporting what they're doing there with the academics and the physical exercise?
If there is a cause that I want to join, it would be the Portland Squash. Not just because of what they've done for me and my family, but for what they're doing for a lot of families out there, especially the immigrant families who otherwise would not have the opportunity. Their kids would not have the opportunity to do as well as they're doing.
You must really believe in it. I'm so impressed that you're able to make time. You have two jobs. You're raising five kids, and you make time to be on the board at Portland Community Squash because you believe in it. And from what I can tell, it just seems that your whole family has excelled, and that's really modeled on you. You have always excelled at everything you've done. What's your dream for your family over the next 10 years? What are you hoping for everyone?
Oh, my goodness. My dream is kind of put on hold for me personally now. But for the family, it's now all about the kids. I wanted to give them what my parents didn't give me. You know, it's all about my kids right now. Just to offer them the best I can to get educated, and hopefully they grow up and be better than me. So that's really my dream, because, I mean, the dreams, I would dream of winning $1 million lottery so I can travel with my kids. My kids, they haven't seen their grandparents, and they're wondering when they're going to go see their grandmas and grandpas. It's hard with five kids working two jobs, mortgage, you got to pay mortgage, and the food on the table, and have extra money to travel with five kids. So I tell them, hey, guys, you know, this is reality. I'm not saying you can go, but it might be have to be divided into groups.
Yeah, right.
I cannot afford to send all of you guys at once. As you know, with Corona, there is obstacles, left and right obstacles.
Mirgani, you are incredibly positive and hardworking. You come from a family that had no access to education, and now you've made many choices that have created opportunities galore for your children. I wish you and your family success in every sense of the word, and thank you so much for being my guest today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Kate Manahan, closing today's program with a song that Mirgani has chosen for us. Can you tell us about the song we're going out on today?
We're going to do Bob Marley, Vincent Jones, You're Right.